These are the Target Files, taking a 21st century look back at the 20th century adventures of the Doctor in novelization and audiobook form, looking through the eyes of adulthood at our childhood memories. After all, a great Time Lord once said, there's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish some of the time. The place, Skaro, time, the birth of the Daleks. After 1,000 years of futile war against the Thals, Davros has perfected the physical form that will carry his race into eternity, the dreaded Dalek. Without feeling, conscience or pity, the Dalek is programmed to exterminate. At the command of the Time Lords, Doctor Who travels back through time in an effort to totally destroy this terrible menace of the future. But even the Doctor cannot always win. Hello and welcome to the very special 50th episode. Yes, we made it to 50 of Doctor Who Target Files. This is Mike in Swansea.
Hello, this is Alex in Exeter. Woo, we're at 50.
Well, hey, and this time, Al, do you want to tell the listeners what we are discussing this week?
We are discussing Doctor Who, Genesis of the Daleks, the DVD and audiobook read by John Coleshaw on the Terence Dix book.
Yes, seen as a great classic by many fans over the years.
Oh, most definitely. It's an essential major Dalek story, really. It sort of gives you a lot of back history to the Daleks and why they're sort of so evil and aggressive and nasty. And there's lots of fantastically memorable scenes in this. Tom is definitely at his best in this.
On the research for this, I watched the DVD release from To Entertain. It may have been standalone first, and then it was part of a Davros box set.
I believe so. I've got it as a standalone thing last week. But I think it was in the big Davros box set they bought a few years ago. You got everything, which I think you still can get.
Yes, and a great documentary on there called Genesis of a Classic. This occurred in Tom Baker's first season, going on 1974 into 1975. There was a change of production team from the dynamic duo of Terence Dix and Barry Letts to Robert Holmes and Philip Hinchcliffe. First written and approached by Terry Nation, creator of the Daleks, of course, and Barry Letts tells an amusing story about how the script was sent in by Terry Nation. Terry asked how it had gone down with the production team, and Terence and Barry mentioned to Terry Nation that it's a fine story, but it's just one you've sold to us 3 times before.
Oh dear, well, that's always the way sometimes when you come up with a good idea, you try to get it accepted as many times, don't you?
Sorry to use that awful word again, Al, but derivative of his previous Dalek stories. So Barry Letts actually made the suggestion and used the word, why don't you go back, Terry, and look at the genesis of the Daleks? And that was the initial seed being planted, and we ended up with this classic story, albeit through a change of production team and script editor.
Oh, most definitely. And it's just so good. I don't give too much away, but it's just so good from that minute, the minute it starts, so really all the way through. I don't think there's each episode, there's so much going on in it. It's like pace, and everything's worth watching. So I think it's a really deserved that. I know we say it too often, like classic, but I think this one really is a classic.
Yes, as we said, it's a Terence Dix book. Al, any hints of it being a simple A to B plot, or do you think it's one of Terence's stronger works?
It's in the middle, because there are some, there are some bits, later on, where it's sort of A to B, got to find the time ring, so we go from there. There's a lot of going up and down corridors, I suppose, and running, but I think there's some really good bits. And the way that they separate the companions, like Harry being the Doctor and sort of Sarah being with the renegade Fowl, the other sort of generation of Scarlet, and it works really well, I think.
Jumping ahead a bit there, Al, but the very opening scene, I'm in a hard mind of to which version I prefer. I think it's sort of equally strong across all three mediums, the TV version, the novelisation and the audiobook. It really puts you into that atmosphere of the deep and dark position of Skaro at war at that time.
All work, really, in my opinion. I love how it's shot on screen. It looks very sort of cinematic, the sort of whole sort of nuclear war that's been ravaging Skaro, and the way the Time Lord sort of tricked the Doctor into being there without him knowing. But I think the book maybe gives it a little bit more depth, which is the good thing about it. But I really like all three, really.
Very cinematically shot, as you said, for the 70s, isn't it? And when we get into the indoor scenes, they're so very well lit as well.
Beautifully lit, there's sort of long shots, it makes you feel very sort of claustrophobic, when they first get there, looking at these sort of dead bodies, and they use them as sort of target practice and all sorts of nasty sort of nuclear war that's been going on in Skara. And I think the way it's shot is beautiful, and the music's great in the background, it gives that really good pace.
Yeah, and I just want to read a bit from the novelisation I have here, Al. I got the reprint here from 2016, I think it came back out again. And, the very first line, it was a battlefield. The ground was churned, scarred, ravaged. Nothing grew there, nothing lived. The twisted, rusting wrecks of innumerable war machines littered the landscape. It's so vivid, isn't it? It's so visceral.
It's really, sort of immediately you listen to that and read it, it sort of tells you exactly that, this place is a wasteland, it's sort of being nuclear, there's nothing there, and it's sort of, this war's been going on so long, because, when the Doctor and that find the bodies, there's like four different types of, different types of weapon from over, like 1,000 years of war, really.
And there's a great sort of throw back in Doctor Who, and also a throw forward to the future of Doctor Who in this scene, as we have a Time Lord visiting the Doctor there, that transposed him from the previous adventure to the battlefields of Skaro. And that sort of thing happens, I think, is it Terror of the Autons when the Master first appears and a Time Lord sort of comes out of time very differently dressed to this one, dressed in a sort of Englishman's 70s bowler hat and holding a briefcase saying that the Master's on the loose on Earth. But they've used that device again.
I think it is that one. I think there's a lot of, these sort of war scenes, the Genesis and the Dark, I think there's a lot in the... it kept reminding me of the Season 9, Peter Capaldi first to apply. It did remind me an awful lot of that.
Yes, and that was The Witch's Familiar and The Magician's Apprentice was broadcast more or less on the 40th anniversary year, wasn't it, of Genesis. So that was something definitely planned by Moffat.
Oh, definitely, because there's this one, that one scene where, Tom puts his foot on a land button. I thought it was so close. There's sort of, one of the scenes out of The Witch's Familiar. It was sort of very close to that.
Yeah, I just want to talk about that Time Lord strange dress again. It's a little bit Rent-A-Go style. Do you remember that programme?
I do indeed. I do remember it. It's a little bit... No, we just threw a costume at him, isn't it? The sort of one they gave to the Time Lord's sort of costume. I think they have improved. Now, there's ones we've had recently with the big collars and the beautiful robes have been really nice. But back then, it was sort of, you've got to look impressive, so we just throw a sort of a robe thing over you.
But he is sort of dressed in black, isn't it? And that's sort of... brings up images, having seen the whole story before, of Davros later on and the Master wearing the black tunic in the earlier incarnations, and we saw Sim wearing it again.
Time Lord seem to like either light or black clothing. It seems like that, I think, and it sort of brings out their sort of, you know, malevolence, I think, when you get to look at the Master, the way he's dressed and that.
Good use of the word malevolence there, Al. I was just going to think of that. Are we meant to think it's such a dark story that it is quite a malevolent mission for the Doctor to go on at this point when it comes to terms of the huge moral decision he has to take later in the book?
I think by the end of the book, when we have the big moral decision, it gets very like that. But I think he's just very curious at the beginning. You know, when they say, oh, you're on Skara, and it's before Daleks were invented, he's very curious to see how they are in the beginning, I think.
And there's that great sort of device in that, yes, Doctor, we assumed you would agree to this mission. That just shows off their pomposity again, doesn't it? One of the reasons why the Doctor wanted to get away in the first place, why he doesn't get on with his people.
Oh, totally. He'll just take it in completely that, you know, he'll do it anyway. So we take straight the Skara anyway. So it's sort of, you know, you don't have a choice.
Absolutely, absolutely. And as we're moving forward a little bit, Sarah Jane and Harry and the Doctor, do they get separated at this point, or is it later on, Al?
It's, I think it's about another 10, 15 minutes into it before they get separate, when they get sort of captured. The Doctor and Harry get captured, and I think Sarah gets knocked unconscious, and then she ends up with the other part of Skara, I think, with the rocket and all that.
Yes, we have the introduction shortly after of the first of many supporting characters in this story. Sevran and Betan, the Thal warriors. How do you feel they came across, Al, in all mediums of the story?
I think they come across quite well. I think they can be a bit characterised as sort of freedom fighters and that sort of stereotype, but I think they actually come across really well. They have a good purpose of being there, and they can sort of see how their planet is being corrupted by, you know, Davros and all his schemes, and they want to fight against it.
Yeah, Sevran, I'm always put in mind. I think the actor's name was Stephen Yeardley, and rather more famously, possibly for yourself, born a few years after me, Al, he played a very sleazy character called Ken Masters in the Sunday night soap opera Howard's Way.
Oh, yeah, I know him. Yeah, he does play quite sleazy in that. It's like, he's very good in this. He does have a purpose to being there, and I think he helps Sarah Jane out when she's not coping well with the rocket things. I think they have a point of being there. I mean, I think it gets over well, you know, the difference between the races, I think.
Yes, and it's interesting to see he was such a sleazy, sort of pretentious, wannabe rich guy in Howard's Way, being so brilliantly dressed and coiffured, as you might say, all the time, and in this he's wearing just a couple of rags.
Oh, definitely. I think the costumes are really good in this, they're sort of run down. I mean, if you look at these up to, you know, like Davros's, you know, staff and clients, you know, like Nido's in like beautiful SAS sort of, you know, clothing, where here it's all rags and costumes. It looks great, though.
Yes, and Sevran's dynamic partner in time and space and Skaro in this story is Betan. I really did think she was a very strong, well-written female character, Al.
Yeah, I did like her. Well, I thought she started off a bit weak. By the end of the story, she's a real freedom fighter and sort of helping out. And she, you know, that bit at the, right at the end, I won't spoil quite yet, but it's really well done. I think the actress playing is really good at it.
Yes, I wasn't sure when I'd gone back to watching this after a few years without, whether she had actually survived the story. Not a huge spoiler, folks, but I was very glad that her and Sevran did.
Yeah, I think they do. You're not too sure, but I think they do right at the end. They do survive.
Yeah, but it's a great growth of her character, as you said, you know, slightly meeker at the beginning, but becomes a real strong female force and pretty much the leader, isn't she, of the group right at the end?
Oh, definitely, by the end. I think that process works really well, because I found her a bit weak at the beginning, and there's sort of a really nice growth, and not to spoil it, but, you know, she's there right at the end, you know, pressing the button to destruct Davos' bunker. It's like really strong female character.
Yes, I like the way they strip back the reveal of the characters in this story. You know, they take it one by one. Sevran and Betan get Sevran, first of all, isn't it, gets a bit of time with Harry and Sarah, and then we start to see the elements, pretty much Third Reich elements, stripped back of the Khaleds, don't we?
Oh, most definitely. It sort of feels very Third Reich the way they're portrayed. I expect that was the point at the time. It's sort of, you know, Nazism and that. It's having Davros definitely as a sort of Hitler character with, you know, like his people around him, like Nido, who are definitely sort of like an SAS leader. When you look at them, their uniforms are stunningly nice. You can see why they go with Davros, really. And it's a real Nazi film to the sort of music, the sort of way that sort of way they don't actually do the high Hitler type where he always sort of taps his foot for doing anything Nida does. It's brilliant.
Yeah, so many wonderful acting flourishes out there. And another one we see before Nida, you could almost have him competing as the villain of the piece, is Guy Siner playing Ravon.
Oh, definitely, because you don't know for quite a long time, you know, if Ravon's on the Doctor's side or he's with Davros. I think it works really well. It's a good sort of slow build, and then you think he's quite evil. Then you meet Nida, and you go, no, he's a prison captain, Nida. You know, Nida will shoot you without even thinking.
Yes, definite elements of Himmler there, isn't there, in Nida?
Oh, totally. There's definitely elements of all the sort of most nastiest bits of, you know, the Nazis, and you know, the whole fact that him and Davros don't really blink about, you know, mutilating and not, you know, genociding a whole dome with a nuclear bomb. They don't think it's anything different.
And is he sort of the definition, Nida, of a Machiavellian character? The way he sort of plays off both sides, but at the same time he's always doing Davros's bidding.
I would think so, because he doesn't really have, you know, sometimes he has his own agenda, but he's always putting it forward for Davros. He's making Davros, you know, the main to play. You know, there's that whole great bit right at the end where, you know, he gets, I've got the other character's name has just gone out of my head, to confess, and then, you know, he makes out, I know, I'm not, you know, I'm with you, I'm not with Davros, and it's so brilliantly done.
Yeah, Garman, played by...
That's who I was trying to think of.
Yes, played by Dennis Chinnery. Almost 50 minutes, Al. We haven't really spoken about the audiobook yet, released just a week ago, performed by the great John Culshaw. Your sort of initial teaser thoughts on his performance?
I think it's really good. Like, you know, John Culshaw is like, you know, if you can't get Tom to do it, get John Culshaw to do it, because he's impressive. It's always an impressive one. The characterization of Tom is so good, but you wouldn't really know what Tom wasn't doing it. And yeah, I really liked it. I think, but I did have one niggle. We were discussing this earlier. There was a good soundscape, but it was quite a loud, over the top soundscape. What did you think? It sort of interrupted the reading a bit.
I was so focused on John's voice by the end. I wouldn't necessarily totally agree with that, Al. It can be quite invasive, but we know it is quite a dark story when you consider perhaps how over the top they have gone on some of these audio releases, although we generally tend to really rate the soundscapes.
I rate it. I think it's really good. I just thought at some point it was a bit loud. That was my only concern, but I really liked it. I thought, you know, the whole gunshots and explosions were really good in there.
Yes, and then we have the menace as well, don't we? I mean, I did see you earlier in the week, Al, didn't we? We met up in Bristol, and I did mention how I was still at this stage with listening to a John Culshaw novel where I'm expecting him to speak as Tom Baker and have a joke at the end of every sentence. And that was the case at the beginning of this book. But once I got into the superb words of Dix, I got the essence of the story on the audiobook, I was totally in the zone of listening to it. I really did start to appreciate John's great efforts at Tom's voice and the other voices in the story.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from. You know, you expect him to go, you know, like a line of text and laugh at him, the Tom Baker laugh. But it really does work, because I think John knows exactly when to start going from comedy to, like, you know, really dark. And this book gets very, very dark very quickly because of the subject matter of, you know, do you do genocide or not genocide? You know, it gets dark very quickly, this book.
Yes, and one thing I did wonder about was whether himself or Nick Briggs had the treatment for Davros's voice, but it is so reminiscent. If you watch the DVD at the same time as we both have, Al, it is so reminiscent of Michael Wisher, the way it's treated and performed. It is eerily similar.
It's really good, his Davros, because we were discussing earlier when we met up, and I couldn't tell that I thought it was Nick Briggs doing, but it's definitely John Culshaw doing, and it's really scarily close. Like, you know, I had it on while, you know, Sunday while I was watching the DVD, and you can't tell the difference. That's why I thought it was Nick Briggs doing it, he's modulating, because it's so close to the Davros voice.
Yes, and I'd like to speak as well about his performance of Nida, Peter Miles, in the story. He really does the word capture again. He does capture, I'd almost call it a sly smugness.
Yeah, I think so. I think that gets that essence of Nida really well, I think John Colton does. And it's sort of that sort of very sort of subtleness, you know, I'm in control of you, basically. And it's really well done by John Culshaw.
almost like sarcastic glee, he puts the end at the end, Peter Miles, of a lot of lines, doesn't he?
Oh, Peter Miles has an awful lot, you know, and we've met regenerating, and you can see that he can still do it, but it's like so much stuff. He must have nearly as much as the Doctor in.
Yes, superb story. I did meet him a few times. There was a Doctor Who Day around the 50th anniversary at the Dylan Thomas Literature Centre here in Swansea, and Peter Miles came down for that. So that was 2013. I think we saw him at Regenerations last year, 16, and he's actually walking with a cane now, but he was still in very good vocal spirits and had the great voice still. But he actually recorded for my friend the famous line from this, "Thank you, you told me exactly what I needed to know." Yeah, this was 38 years later in 2013 when he recorded this for my friend, and it was still there, you know. He could still play Nida.
I think what we saw at Regen, didn't they do quite a big chunk on stage one, and it was still quite terrifying.
Yeah, pretty amusing story with Terry Malloy as well, wasn't there?
Yes, is that the one we can tell or not tell? Was that the one with the certain word in it?
No, that's a different story from Terry.
That's a different story.
No, that was a few years before Regenerations, not in front of Mr. Miles or with any children in the room, thankfully. But, you know, that's just Terry's way.
Yeah, joys of Terry Malloy. Fun, but very interesting.
No, I think Peter Miles was telling a story there last year, wasn't he? And because he walks with a stick now, he's a little frail up on his feet. Terry actually acted out the performance for him, and I remember Terry wearing a kilt and holding a little teddy bear up for some reason. If anybody at Regenerations can remember the context of that story, please let us know, folks, at DW Target Files.
I do know what you're on about. Well, I've forgotten as well.
Yes, a lovely man, but Nida, such a intense character, isn't he? You know, one of those strange characters in literature that you really love to hate, don't you?
Really enjoy his character. What you'd hate him easily. They sort of. Well, those people who are great, but just in it for themselves, really.
And spoiler, folks, a 5-second warning. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. When it comes to Nida's demise, you are a little disappointed, Al, don't you? You think he'd like to be one of those ones that could survive for another story?
Yeah, that's why I only niggle about the TV and that episode. The way they get, you know, the way the spoiler comes, the way the Daleks sort of, you know, go against Nida and Davros, I think it's a bit weak, personally.
Yes, one of the major scenes in this story, which set up a trope which has lasted really for all subsequent, or most of the TV Davros stories, is the sort of intellectual conversation between him and the Doctor. I mean, it's set up quite blatantly in this story, as the Doctor has just been more or less tortured or forced into giving away future Dalek victories to Davros. He calmly says at the end, "Now, Doctor, let's speak as men of science." And it's the first of one of many great conversations down the years, Al. How do you feel Dix wrote that, and how did it come across in the audiobook and the TV version?
Oh, I think it is, you know, the starting point of all the later great Davros conversation we have, and I think in the DVD with Tom and Davros, it works so well. It's so charged, and you know, Davros just gets more manic by the end of the scene. You know, Tom's Doctor's thinking, "Oh, I tell him this, and I give him this explanation. He won't do it. He just thinks it's great. You know, I can become more powerful, and I can become ruler of everything." You know, and it's just over the years, you know, the different Doctors and Davros, we see these sort of intellectual conversations all the way up to the great Sylvester McCoy, which is fantastic. And I think in this, it comes over well, and I think in the audiobook it's a really good performance as well. You know, it's more, maybe a little bit more detailed, I thought, in the audiobook. Well, I think it's one of the seminal Doctor Who scenes, I think.
I'm not so much a controversial opinion, Al, but I'd probably say it's one of the times I think Moffat probably wrote that sort of intellectual scene with Davros better than RTD did in Journey's End, which was more sort of a whiz-bang explosions at the screen adventure.
What you mean, that one in Journey's End is so quick, where the one in, is it in the first part or the second part of the Davros story?
The Witch is Familiar.
Yeah, so The Witch is Familiar, and that really good scene where he gives him some regeneration, he gets tricked and gives some regeneration to Davros, and it's a really nice, long, old-style scene. It did between Peter and Davros' character. It just works really well. I think, yeah, I'm like you. I think the Russell T. Davis period, it's very short and brief. I think it didn't have its space.
Yeah, so I was glad Julian Bleach came back for the second time, because he was probably a little bit more like Michael Wisher's original performance in the Moffat stories.
Yeah, I think so. He knew that. I think he knew Davros better, and it sort of felt more Genesis Davros than sort of later Davros.
Moffat's borrowed that great line from his Curse of the Fatal Death comic relief special, saying, "Doctor, I have something unique for you. The only other chair on Skaro."
I know, that worked really well, actually. I like that line.
But yes, it's a wonderfully structured conversation by Terry Nation, isn't it? Written by Terry Nation and script edited by Robert Holmes.
Yeah, I think it works really well, because the Doctor is trying to get Davros on his side and, you know, listen to him, and, you know, all he's hearing is power and how great the Daleks will be in the future, and that's unfortunately what happens with, you know, Maniacs. They see only the power and the present of what can happen.
And then the setup is there by the Doctor, you know, mentioning, could Davros do this if he had the power? And then he's actually put in that situation himself later on. And actually quite, I don't know how I take to Sarah Jane being the one who tries to encourage the Doctor to do it, because he does use the lines which Moffat borrowed again in the Season 9 opener, mentioning, if you had the chance to alter or destroy a child, if he knew it was going to grow up to be a maniac. And then we saw Capaldi's Doctor, didn't we, in Season 9, actually meet Davros as a child.
Yeah, it's a very interesting one, because you sort of think that, you know, Sarah would be against genocide, you know, and she wouldn't, you know, let the Doctor do this. Well, I think she has that sort of attitude. She's obviously, you know, she's met the Daleks in the past, yeah. She knows what they're like. So I think it's an interesting one, having Sarah as the, yeah, you must do it, Doctor, where he just can't go through with it. And I really like when we met Davros, you know, as a child later, you know, there's Peter Moffat, yeah, give a time away, the Peter Capaldi era, it really worked. And I like the fact that Big Finish have also examined the whole Davros' children, child period on Skaro, and it's a really interesting period, I think.
I think Davros is one of my very favourite Big Finish plays, Al. I've listened to it a number of times.
It's really good, isn't it? And it sort of gives you that really interesting outlook on how, you know, Davros becomes the sort of maniac monster we know in the future, really.
Apparently, this whole issue of morality, Terence Dix mentions in the Genesis of a Classic documentary on the DVD release. This was something that got Doctor Who once again into a bit of hot water with Mary Whitehouse. And Terence pretty memorably says, if there's one thing guaranteed to get Mary Whitehouse's back up more than sex on TV, it was Doctor Who.
Well, yeah, because there's that one shot, isn't it, before the episode ends, where he goes into sort of the tank of all the Daleks and they're very squiddy, and it's a nasty scene. Well, I find it just funny. You know, he used to wind Mary Whitehouse up to the hilt, the Robert Holmes, Philip Hinchcliffe period. I don't know how many times they got themselves into serious hot war with her, because they just liked horror, like we do. They liked horror and they liked making Doctor Who a bit more adult, I think.
Yes, reached its culmination really with The Deadly Assassin a few years later, didn't he? A famous scene there.
Is that the one that's got the drowning scene in?
Yes, Tom's face held underwater for a number of seconds, and there's actually a freeze frame on it, so the effect lasts, or the argument was the effect lasted longer for child's minds at that time.
Oh, God, I doubt it did. It just sort of thought, you know, what is the Doctor going to get out of that predicament, I expect?
And he's Doctor Who, he always was going to.
Yeah, he was always going to. I never got the Mary Whitehouse argument, because you knew that it was the Doctor, and next week's episode, they would have found some way of him getting out of that.
It's a different world nowadays, Al, isn't it? You know, people have, whereas television perhaps is one of the only main platforms for having that side of an argument at the time, we have social media nowadays, we see it's all over there, you know, people trying to control what we see and hear.
I just think it's definitely agreeing, you know, it was times back then, it was like, and also you had, you know, this, as it being a series, you had the sort of week for it all be discussed by people like Mary Whitehouse, and, you know, thought Doctor Who was full of horrible things.
Yes, Al, a lot of characters throughout this book sadly have a bit of demise. We have Ronson's a pretty memorable scientist, isn't he?
Yeah, he gets bumped off quite, you know, quite quickly, and he's sort of person who comes up with all the ideas to begin with, you know, what Davros sort of takes on, really, doesn't he? So I think he's a really good, memorable character.
And John Coleshaw plays him with a great deal of enthusiasm, him and Garman as well, the two who sort of waver towards the right side at the end, don't they?
Oh, definitely, definitely. They're sort of in-the-middle characters, which makes them really interesting, because you don't know if they're with Davros or against Davros, and it sort of works very nicely. You sort of slowly see that they're not in their own favour of this sort of revolution that's going to happen.
Yes, and then we have the Doctor, Harry and Sarah aiming to escape from Skaro, thinking more or less the job is done, don't they? And they have a bit of the scuffle trying to get the time rin back, and Nida escapes from them once more. And then it sets out the horrible sort of Machiavellian plot at the end, the double-crossing of Davros.
Oh, definitely. Some lovely, lovely scenes between, you know, the Doctor, Harry and Nida. And then you get that whole sort of double-cross at the end. And the last episode full of really good sort of dialogue and character bits, basically, from Nida, the Doctor. You know, Harry's doing his normal sort of stuff, but he's not too bad. But it's just really, I really enjoyed it. You know, it sort of goes along with really good pace.
One thing I felt at the end is that there's generally a bit of happiness between Harry and Sarah and everybody, but the fact is a lot of people are still going to meet their demise on this planet, aren't they?
Yeah, I think it sort of tries to be that positive swing with the last speech the Doctor says, you know, to Harry and Sarah. But you just think, well, Matt, you think they're going to go off for the timer and get to the TARDIS, and another probably 100 people will die, because this sort of war will continue and continue like wars do.
Yes, and I suppose you have to keep the timeline intact in terms of Tom meeting Davros again a few years later in Destiny, and right back to Hartnell then, don't we, you know, meeting them in the future.
The timeline works, but you still have that sort of nigger in your head, but things are going to go even worse with Skaro, I think.
Yes, and they do mention, I think, in the book, I'm not sure if it's in the TV story, that they're going to build a city, don't they? After they have more or less, spoilers folks, hoisted Davros by his own petard.
Oh, definitely. I don't think the city bit's actually in the TV episode, but I know what you mean. It works better in the book, that idea. You get a bit of sense of hope, but I just think, you know, you sort of think, how long will the hope last?
And is it in the book, Al? I think they only blast his hand, whereas on TV it's not implicit, but it's more or less seems as though he has been finished off once and for all.
Yeah, in the book they sort of don't do it as bad as it is. The Daleks sort of blast him completely in the TV episode, but I think in the book it's just his hand they go for.
Yes, I think they obviously thought he might come back by that point, because the book was published first on the 27th of July 1976, so sort of halfway between Genesis on the TV and Destiny in 1978.
Yeah, so obviously he knew he was coming back.
Yeah, sadly not with Michael Wisher again. How would you rate all the Davroses, Al? I think they've all brought something different to the role, but for me, I think I would like to have seen a bit more of Michael Wisher.
Different. They all have that sort of slight manicness to what Davros has to have. I agree that Michael Wisher is definitely probably the best one out of the lot. But I do enjoy Terry Molloy's Davros. It's a bit more manic, but more on the sort of camp manic sort of spectrum. And then, yeah. The most recent one's been good as well. I think they work really well.
I think perhaps if Wisher was the Hitler at Nuremberg, I think elements of Terry Molloy are possibly Mel Brooks' Hitler in Springtime for Hitler.
Oh, well, how great is that? But yeah, I agree. It probably would be more like that.
And whereas Julian Bleach is just, he's found something new again. What else do you think he's found new in the...
I think he's found the element of making Davros a bit more likeable in some ways. I really, you know, before he sort of sprung that trap on Peter Capaldi's Doctor, you really were beginning to feel sorry for him, and I think he gets that over really well.
Yeah, I can't remember if he ranted much at the end of the Capaldi two-parter, but in Journey's End he almost sort of
manic in Journey's End. He rants like no man's business in Journey's End, and then he goes, "It's all your fault, Doctor." That's really ranted.
But it's almost sort of an acceptance of his fate by then, whereas there's a real sort of pleading in Genesis, isn't there?
Yeah, that bit right at the end. You can't believe that his creations have sort of turned on him.
And the idea of him mentioning the word pity is so ironic.
I know, there's those great bits over the years with Davros. He has this pity, and everybody thinks, well, how can you say pity when you're a maniac who created the Daleks? So, you know what, you do have pity for people like that, though.
Certainly, if you think about prequels, as they'd be called nowadays, things like the Star Wars trilogy, episodes 1, 2, 3, which didn't really work. I think prequels-wise, Genesis certainly is one of the better ones across any sort of sci-fi film or TV show.
Yeah, I would agree, because it sort of tells you an awful lot, but doesn't do it badly. You know, we did have to mention the terrible Star Wars films there, because they are terrible. But I do have some time for Revenge of the Sith. I forget, I'm not quite sure what I call it. That one does work out the three. Well, I think as a prequel in the sort of sci-fi land, this works the best, I think.
Yeah, one thing I was wondering about, is it the Khaleds that are all sort of blonde and a bit Aryan-like in the initial Dalek story, the first one?
I think they are meant to be that sort of whole Aryan thing where they are blonde and blue-eyed and look, you know, stunning under good light.
But does that sort of fit in with their appearance in Genesis? Do you know why did they evolve to become this? Although I suppose they didn't know the origins of Genesis at the time when they wrote the Daleks.
I suppose there's no element of connecting, unfortunately, because as you said, the Daleks was written an awful long time before Genesis. But you know, they can be connected. You can see the connections, I suppose.
One last thing we don't always get in the Target books are chapter titles, and these are really evocative of the old Saturday morning serials you hear about, you know, right from number one, Secret Mission, to number seven, Countdown to Destruction, number 10, Decision for the Doctor, 12, A Kind of Victory, which does sort of sum up my thoughts then about the ending.
Yeah, I think the titles are really good, as you know, some Target books you don't get them. I think you sort of know when you get a title in these sort of books where you're going, and I think that works well with this.
On to covers, Al, we have the 1976 edition, Chris Achilleos, a very pale yellow background, the Doctor in a bubble almost on a screen, pencil drawn or slightly shaded in brown, Davros browny black of his tunic. His facial details very prominent. Chris Achilleos won this. The very top of his Dalek base as he moves around in, and a classic grey Dalek over his left shoulder. Doctor Who and the Genesis of the Daleks, the Pertwee or sometimes Baker, I think, logo, and black writing. Pretty prominent one, Al. It has Davros on there, it has the Dalek, it has Tom.
Yeah, that does seem to have an awful lot of stuff on it. Well, it's a good thing, but it sort of tells you everything, really. I think you definitely look at that. That's sort of, you know, really good pencil drawings are always great.
And then we had a 1991 reprint, Alistair Pearson. A lot more colour, more detail, really. Davros there, drawn from the opposite angle, really, the opposite side. He's slightly off kilter, with Tom just appearing in the grey mist behind and a white background. That strange ribbon logo they had on the reprints with the Sylvester McCoy logo there. Terence Dix in red writing, but not too prominent to see down the bottom. Possibly prefer the first one, Al, which was recreated.
I would agree though, because I think with the sort of, you know, what's going on in the context of the story, I think too much colour is a bit too much. So I think it needs to be sort of, you know, washed out and white, because what's going on in the story, really.
And I think perhaps for the 2016 reprint last year, a much better balance. You get the original Chris Achilleos elements of Davros, the grey Dalek, and Tom drawn in a certain shade of brown, orangey sort of brown, in a circle, transposed onto the cream background of the reprints, with the Doctor Who Pertwee McGann-esque logo, Genesis of the Daleks in green, and much smaller writing for Terence Dix. I think it's possibly one of those occasions where I think the most recent, the reprint, is probably my favourite.
That's really nice, because it's a really nice balance, because I think if it's too bright, it sort of doesn't really work with the context of the story. Well, that sounds a really nice balance, that does.
Talking about John Coulshaw again, he's going to be doing this Five Doctors next month. Has this whetted your appetite for that one?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really good read. You know, you're going to follow Nick Briggs as well, because, you know, you've got Daleks, you've got Cybermen, you've got to do all that. But I think have I heard him do other Doctors? I've heard him, we've all heard him do Tom Baker. Well, he's going to have to do Pertwee and all the rest in this. So I think it'll be an interesting one.
There was an episode of Confidential broadcast after Blink, I think, in the UK, a decade ago now, called Do You Remember the First Time? And it was talking to various people who were fans as children that went on to work in the media. We had Russell and Phil Collinson on there, and we had Nev Fountain, the writer, and John Coulshaw. And I think there's a brief snippet where John definitely does impressions of Troughton, Pertwee, Tom, Davison, Baker, McCoy, he skips McGann, he does Eccleston, and he does David, with David there, which Tennant finds very amusing. But they're very rare snippets, but if you can find it, folks, I think it's on the 2007 Season 3 box set.
Season 3 box set.
So if you can get all the elements of those in The Five Doctors, which is the very first Target book I remember owning with a wonderful sort of hologram silver cover, folks, then it should be another excellent release.
Definitely. It has a really good cover to that book. I remember that as well. It sort of will be interesting, because I think with the problem of the, I would say it's about the actual TV version, I think it gets a bit crowded and cluttered, but I think with the audiobook and the book, it will be a lot more sort of in-depth story again.
Excellent, Al. Before we do some news today, shall we wrap up and look at our scores for Genesis of the Daleks across the three mediums?
It's a really interesting, because I don't know if I could go really high or in between. So I really, really like the TV episodes. I think they are stunning from start to finish. I think they're shot beautifully, like a little mini film, really. It'd be nice if you could have it all as one thing instead of separate episodes. I think it worked better that way. And I think the acting from Tom and this lady and all the people is really, really good. And I really enjoyed the book because it's a bit more detailed and has different elements going on. John Coleshaw's, you know, reading of the audiobook is fantastic. There's some really good soundscape between all the explosions and, you know, gun smoke. It really makes you feel like you're in the middle of a war, really, which is good. So, this is the query. Do I go really high and give it a 10, or do I go on about 9.5? I think I have to go in for a 10 with the DVD, but I think 9.5 for the rest.
Yeah, similar again for me, Al. I'm going to mark it down just a bit, because I think maybe four parts would be perfect for this. I think it does drag a bit around about the missile silo and the whole issue of the Doctor getting in and out of the missile and, you know, Sarah being caught up there with Severin. So I'll just sort of mark it down half a point for that. I'll give it a solid 9.5. But thoroughly recommended. Purchase the audiobook released last week, folks.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
Hello there, this is Alex, and this is Who's News on October the 13th. And the first thing we need to discuss about is the great Matt Lucas, who's got his autobiography finally out, Little Me and Aid Said, which is a sort of comprehensive guide of his whole life, going into lots of fun details. We met up with him again on Monday in Bristol, where he had a talk and discussing about his book. It was very interesting. Finally, we have a release date for the Season 10 Complete Blu-ray or Blu-ray Steelbook, depending on which version you want to get. It has all 13 episodes of the Season 10, plus last year's Christmas special, and has oodles of extras, one of them being the binaural version of Knock Knock, the great David Suchet episode. Sharda is now being released with animated lost episodes at the end. It will be out on two formats. It will be out on DVD on November 24th, and then on high-end Blu-ray, we can hope, on the 4th of December. BigFinish.com have out today Doctor Who The Behemoth, starring Colin Baker. It's a sixth Doctor story written by Mark Platt, who of course did Ghostlight many years ago. It also has both of his new companions in it and is probably very good. Also from Big Finish is the Outliers with the Second Doctor, a Simon Gurrier story with Ben, Polly and Jamie.
Okay, Al, as it's the 50th episode of Doctor Who Target Files, we met up in Bristol earlier this week. Would you like to tell the listeners what happened that evening?
We went to the Matt Lucas talk at Bristol University. They went for a bit of food and drink for and chatted over that. And then we went down to the lovely Bristol, I think it's part of Bristol University, and saw an hour talk with Matt going over everything. He's sort of time at Bristol University, and he seemed to still know Bristol very well. Obviously, Bristol hasn't changed that much since he was there. And it was great fun. It was really good. And we got around to meeting and got a photo of him after the talk. It was really good.
Yes, and I bought the print version of his book, as well as already having the audio book, and Matt signed that. And a couple of interesting Doctor Who questions in that one, Al. He actually mentioned, when asked what the question was, what was your favourite moment in Doctor Who, and he said he actually couldn't tell us yet, so that strongly suggests to me and to others there that he is going to be appearing as Nardole again in Twice Upon a Time, the Christmas special.
I think it's pretty definite where he's in the Christmas special, because I'm sure there were some photos early on where you saw him there and he thought he wouldn't answer it. You know, apparently his favourite moment must be in that with probably David Bradley in a big part. There must be a really good scene with Nardole, I think, because he wouldn't tell anybody anything.
Speaking about his book, Al, a very interesting A to Z format of his life. I've not seen a autobiography done like that before, but a really strong, I thought, audio book performance.
Oh, most definitely. The audiobook is a really, really addictive listen. I did it in 2 days. I mean, it's a big audiobook. But I think the A to Z is good if you're not manic like me. You can just dip in anywhere. And some really fun bits in it. His life is very interesting. But it's even though it's a bit guarded, I think, on some things, I think it comes over very well.
Yeah, there's a definite love of performance from Matt.
Well, yeah, you don't get with most audiobook versions even a song in the middle, so it's great. It's really enjoyable listen.
Yeah, sort of any memorable highlights without spoiling the whole thing, Al? There's lots of memorable moments for me, but any ones that stand out for you from the audiobook?
There's this thing. I like all his stuff about a very interesting chapter called TARDIS, which you think is all going to be about Doctor Who, which goes off on a very interesting tangent, a very sort of emotional tangent. I think the whole context of, you know, Little Britain and how it can't really come back today, he talks about very well. Having though it's about an hour and a half, the whole chapter on being gay is very interesting and really fun, but it doesn't seem as long as it is. It's about an hour, I think, the chapter on that, and I think it works really well as an audiobook.
Career-wise for Matt, it's great to see someone really following their childhood dream, and you really get a sense of liking for the guy. You know, we've met him a few times, and what stood out for me was probably a large section at the end on Shooting Stars, which was such a memorable show in the UK back here in the 90s. Getting to meet his heroes at the time, heroes of many of our generation, Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer, getting to work with them on that show, Shooting Stars, and later on in his career, getting to be in Les Miserables, you know, something he'd pretty much dreamed about all his life, and it seemed quite unlikely earlier on in his career he'd ever be in it. He got that dream, didn't he, around about 2010?
Yeah, definitely. And it was really good, isn't it, what I heard. I never got around to seeing it, but just that whole sort of really good work effort he sort of had. And you know, you meet some people and, they're quite standoffish. It's like we've met people in the Who world who aren't, but they can be quite standoffish actors. And suddenly, you know, he's a really nice sort of person who, you know, gives up his photos for, you know, where he's just thinking, you know, he's actually got where he wants to be, I think.
Yeah, you do get the impression with certain people you may meet at conventions that it is a bit of a chore for them. Sometimes it's time constraints. If you go to the larger events, you literally have just a few seconds with a person, whether it's a photo or having their autograph. Sometimes there's a no-talk policy. But there was probably about, I'd say, 30 to 40 people in the queue, but it was so quick-moving, even though more or less Matt was having a photo with everybody.
He was having a photo with everybody, and he was having at least a good couple of minutes to chat with everybody. You know, as you know, we've both been to conventions where you're sort of cattled into the photo. You take the photo and then the next person comes in. And he didn't feel rushed at all. You know, it was done well, I think.
Yes, and we got to thank him in person again for that interview earlier in the year, folks. Episode 36 of The Target Files, if you can hunt it down. Still available. iTunes, Jellycast, Mixcloud, Doctor Who Podcast Alliance.
Really good what he actually remembers people. I know if I saw 1,000 people there, I would remember who they were.
Yes, and even more so when he has a form of facial aphasia, Al, doesn't he? He mentioned that.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because what the P is in the autobiography, and I can't pronounce it.
Something prognosis, but I did do a little bit of study of aphasia for my degree. Psychology, nearly 20 years ago now, and it's certain levels of difficulty in recognising faces, you know. It's different levels of how it can occur. You know, it might be more severe in more people, but, you know, not to take away from the fact Matt is a wonderful performer, a lovely man from what we've met of him, and should we give a quick score for that? Little Me, A to Z of My Life, Al, which is out
Little
now.
I'd say it's up, well, I really enjoyed it, and I binged it, so I'd say it's up there about a 9.5, I'd say.
Yeah, up there with Genesis of the Daleks on this 50th episode, folks. Probably a 9.5 for me. On to the rest of the Doctor Who world and news, Al. Are you happy we're getting yet another version of Sharda?
Yeah, because I like the one with Big Finish did with Paul McGann. I really enjoyed that, and I think that worked as an audio thing. So it will be interesting to see when you see the finished version if it's any better than that, because I really enjoyed the Paul McGann version of Sharda, the Big Finish way out ages ago, but it's still available on their website, and it's got lots of fun actors in it, so I think that works well.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it's going to jar. I know it's how they manage the transition, isn't it, from the footage that does survive from 1979 into the animation.
Well, they've done it a few times now, so I think they'll probably know what they're doing.
It's a good Steelbook Blu-ray to look forward to, jam-packed with extras by the look of it, for season 10.
Oh, yeah, that is a definite, you know, Whovian Christmas present, I think, for people like Doctor Who, like us. It is absolutely... No, you can get the normal Blu-ray, which will just be the unfolding box. Well, I just think the Steelbooks are so much nicer on your shelf, and they, you know, you open it and they're really nice inside, and it'll just be... Really, it's just full of oodles of extras, and the thing I love about it is that with Doctor Who, it seems to be the only thing what BBC do it with, everything has talking menus, so I can watch all the extras.
I think audio description is something that really deeply has to be taken into consideration nowadays, and are you pretty happy with what you've got access to, Al?
I am, but I would love it. I would love it when, because they tried it out, the Hollywood companies tried it out with, you know, on normal Blu-rays having audio description menus. I think they found it too expensive, and I wish more people do it. The BBC have done it on some things, but they seem to have kept it now only for the Doctor Who reigns, and it just works really well. You click on a thing, and all your menus talk, and you can watch all the extras. Which, you know, I like doing. I would be like knowing all the background stuff.
Ah, speaking of which, Al, Genesis probably had quite a few releases in terms of, you know, record of the soundtrack of the LP back in the 70s. One of the very few Doctor Who ones you could get because it was such a popular episode. And I did some research, and the RNIB got Terry Molloy to read this novelisation just a few years ago. The only preview I could find online was him reading the names of the chapters out. But
Has it been? I think it's been deleted or something. Because
you could still rent it, yeah. If you're an RNIB member, Al, you can still rent it as an audiobook from them.
I might have to look into that. But I know. When was it? Might have been last year for Record Store Day, which is, you know, where records come out, especially on the day. They re-bought out Genesis of the Daleks, and it's going for about £60 to £70 on Amazon at the moment.
Okay, so
the full, you know, the TV, the whole basically what you're getting on the DVD, what does the sound basically?
I think you mentioned before that you continued to get Doctor Who magazine in the Wilderness years.
Yeah, I definitely did. That's what got through the Wilderness years period. Me, I always got Doctor Who in print form, and I could still see text, and I get it now on my iPhone because it works beautifully on the iPhone. Only one of the magazines that does actually work beautifully on an iPhone. It works well. Well, I think that's due to a lot of me moaning at the last great editor, you know, or not the editor at the moment, and they have fixed it all, so it works beautifully. But Doctor Who magazine for that Wilderness era bit was the, you know, sort of thing you went to. It's told you, you know, you've got to get the new Avengers books, you know, this is coming out. It's how it kept the whole Doctor Who period alive, really.
Yes, another reason I asked was because Genesis did, for a number of years, seem to top the polls of the top stories, certainly before the new series came back. I had a look at my old magazine stretching back over 10 years since I started buying it again.
It's sort of gone from that, hasn't it? The Caves and Androzani now, isn't it?
Well, it was Caves of Androzani. They did one in around about 2011, 2012, and it was Caves was number one by that point, and Blink was number two, and Genesis was third. And then they did another one after the 50th, and Day of the Doctor had taken over at the top by that time.
Well, I'm not surprised that it's a really good episode, but yeah, it's always sort of been in the top 10 of Doctor Who loving this episode because it's so good.
Yes, definitely a classic, folks. But that was the 50th episode of Doctor Who Target Files. Thank you so much, faithful listeners, for listening to us over these 50 editions, and please contact us at DW Target Files or search Facebook for the Doctor Who Target Files podcast and leave us a message. Bye for now.
Bye, that was great. Next time on the Target Files, we will be discussing Doctor Who Planet of the Giants, written by Terence Dix, read by Caroline Ford.
You can contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at DW Target Files handle, or search Facebook for the Doctor Who Target Files podcast page and leave us a message. Thanks for listening. Doctor Who Target Files, Genesis of the Daleks review, featured Michael Winks and Alexander Gibbons. Genesis of the Daleks music, composed originally by Dudley Simpson. I Am the Doctor, composed originally by Murray Gold. Version for the podcast by Vale Mystery. Please do check out their YouTube channel, VAYLE Mystery. Newsround, opening and closing themes, composed originally by Ted Heath and his orchestra, and by John Baker. Doctor Who Target Files, Genesis of the Daleks review, was recorded in Swansea, Wales, UK, and Exeter, Devon, UK, during October 2017.